Hi, I'm Marie.
And I'm Sydney.
And we're Mess.
Well, not a mess, but on our podcast called Mess, we celebrate all things messy.
But the gag is, not everything is a mess. Sometimes it's just living.
Yeah, things like J-Lo on her third divorce.
Living. Girls' trip to Miami.
Mess.
Breaking up with your girlfriend while on Instagram Live.
Living.
It's kind of mess.
Yeah. Well, you get it.
Got it?
Live, love, mess. Listen to Mess with Sydney Washington and Marie Faustin on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chelsea Handler here on Dear Chelsea. I am joined by my longtime illegitimate baby named Kevin Hart. We talk about his birth. We talk about his afterbirth. We talk about his childhood, his adolescence, and that's pretty much where he is right now.
What do you mean you don't think?
No. What is going on with your legs that they need washing?
It's your body. You wash your body, Chelsea. Your entire body. You don't pick and choose.
I have hot spots. There's this harassment coming from one of us to the other person.
You to me.
Yeah, usually that's true. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. Okay. And you take the abuse very well. You almost seem to enjoy it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've just grown accustomed to it.
Right. Like, okay.
Yeah,
that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Find Dear Chelsea on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Bo.
Hey, Matt.
Can you believe we have yet another very special episode coming up?
This one is very close to my heart. We'll be joined by a friend, the star of the upcoming Wicked film, the one and only Ariana Grande, will be here in the studio with us.
We hope this episode of Lost Coach gives you so much joy.
The episode is dropping this Wednesday, my birthday, November 6th.
And of course, please go see Wicked when it comes out.
November 22nd. Don't miss it.
Listen to Lost Culturistas on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On October 26, 1997, a group of Philadelphia teenagers planned a robbery that took place the following night at a local deli. After closing up, the deli owner, Mr. John Su Kang, was held up and fatally shot in front of the store. After canvassing the neighborhood, police were unable to find out who had pulled the trigger, but finding those who were part of the conspiracy was a much easier task. Those present at the October 26th meeting were willing to testify against three neighborhood kids, one of whom was Tyree Wallace. Despite a wide age gap between Tyree and his co-defendants, as well as multiple false testimonies exposed at trial, Tyree was sentenced to life without parole. But this is wrongful conviction. Wrongful conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison, and now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and tell us how these stories make you feel and what you've done to help the cause, even if it's something as simple as telling a friend or sharing on social media. And you might just hear yourself in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, where another Philadelphia case has come to our attention, in which our guest, Tyree Wallace, was not tied to the October 1997 crime scene. But when you're prosecuted for felony murder in the second degree, you don't have to be. And we'll get into what that means in a minute. But first, let me introduce Tyree, who's joining us from a Pennsylvania correctional facility, a place he doesn't belong in. He never belonged there. But Tyree, thank you for calling in.
You're welcome. Thank you for doing it.
And here with us to help share this harrowing story, his attorney, David Perry.
Thanks for having me.
So, Tyree, you grew up in Philadelphia in the 80s and 90s, right?
Yes, I did. I was born at Children's Hospital. My mother lived on Cleveland Street in South Philadelphia, but she had an alcohol addiction. And as a result of that, I bounced back and forth between she, my father, and sometimes my grandmother. But South Philadelphia, it was pleasant enough, but it was starting to go downhill a little bit based off of drugs in the community. But at its core, it was still good, decent people for the most part.
What you had at that time is a war on drugs, aggressive policing, fear in the community about recidivism, some headline-making situations that caused a bit of a pendulum swing to an extremely aggressive police and district attorney approach to crime in the city of Philadelphia in the late 90s, where a lot of people would say that there was more of an emphasis on clearing cases than there was on finding justice.
And these are familiar touchstones for the crack epidemic era and its aftermath all throughout this country, with most citizens just barely surviving both the crime that emanated from this scourge, as well as a police force that acted with impunity. And the communities pulled through on the strength of folks like the victim in this case, Mr. John Soo Kang. Rest in peace.
He was just the giant in our community. He ran the Salt and Pepper Deli on 17th and Ellsworth. And most of the other Korean-American establishments in South Philly, they normally only hired other people from the Korean-American community. Mr. John intentionally hired from the people who lived in South Philly. The store had a familiar feel as a result of that intentionality. But then you had a bunch of people with jobs who would not otherwise have them if not for Mr. John.
But not everyone is a pillar of the community, like the armed young man or men, potentially even boys, who may or may not have conspired to rob Mr. John as he closed up shop one night in the Salt and Pepper Deli.
At that time of night, there is Mr. Kang working there, of course, and there is LeVan Griffin, the clerk. LeVan Griffin talked of three individuals, perhaps including a woman, come in moments or minutes before the murder. They leave as they're closing up the shop as they would normally do. Mr. Kang is holding a bag of money. LeVan Griffin has already exited the store, heading towards home. And Mr. Kang heads towards his car. LeVan Griffin hears a loud bang, turns around and sees Mr. Kang having fallen to the ground. LeVan Griffin takes off running. There was never really any physical evidence. There's no DNA element to this case. And LeVan Griffin spoke with detectives soon after this. Griffin gives some statement about somebody shorter and more heavy set or chunkier than Tyree, and also darker skinned. LeVan said, "They told me the people who walked into the store right before closing were involved in the shooting, and I personally had no knowledge of this."
We're really not sure where they got that information, considering that the lone witness had just told them that he'd only seen one shooter. Perhaps they were trying to get him to identify the people who'd come into the store, since he had actually seen them and could then serve as a reliable eyewitness, regardless of if those folks were involved or not. Now, we're really not sure of their motives, other than the significant pressure on them to close this case.
It was the absolute talk of the neighborhood. And I remember thinking clearly that they are going to absolutely bury somebody for this. And that would be justified. I'm like, who would do this to Mr. Kang, right? The Korean-American community was in an uproar, and rightfully so, about what happened to Mr. John Young Soo Kang. And they were demanding results. The officer, Charles Boyle, and others in my case decided that we're going to get a conviction.
So the police began canvassing the neighborhood and putting pressure on a number of neighborhood kids, Raheem Shackelford, Matthew Corprew, James Davis, the first two of whom ended up becoming Tyree's co-defendants.
So I was from a block that was called 19th and Annan. All of these guys you just named were all guys from 17th Street. Now, while this is not a great distance, it was two rivaling communities that wouldn't have anything to do with each other. All of the guys, again, that you just named were all 15-year-olds and 14-year-olds. I was 19 years old. We weren't in the same social circles. We were from rivaling communities. We just did not interact.
But there was one source from Tyree's social circle that helped the police link him with Raheem Shackelford and Matthew Corprew.
An associate of mine at the time, Brian Brooks, had a girlfriend named Tracy Drayton. Tracy's nephew was Matthew Corprew. On one occasion at Tracy Drayton's house, I was introducing to Matthew Corprew. We shook hands, never saw him again until I was on trial with him for a robbery homicide.
And the narrative eventually became Tyree and Brian attended a planning meeting with these 14-year-olds the day prior, October 26th, but no one is exactly sure of how this narrative came to be.
I'm not exactly sure if I'll ever really know the order of events. I think there is a degree, I suppose, of going to the usual suspects. And I think one person pointed to another, and it just sort of became what a lot of these guys have said is sort of any two will do. And when it got to a point where they found that they had any two, or in this case, three, they could clear the case and sell it to the jury. But they sort of ricochet off of each other. They knew Brian Brooks was a bad actor because he had about four other robberies.
Interestingly, while under investigation for those robberies, Brian Brooks was arrested just hours before this robbery homicide for an unrelated charge, allegedly with information to trade on.
So at 4:50 p.m., he's in custody and they're interviewing him about a list of crimes. The murder takes place later that night. Now, it's not like Brian says, I'm aware that something's going to go down tonight. So there's no foreshadowing by Brian Brooks. In December, when Brian Brooks is questioned by the police, he says he knows nothing about the murder. Brian Brooks's December police statement is never written down. It's only ever talked about. But how do we know that it occurred? At least we believe it occurred because Brian Brooks would be questioned in a police statement, which is written down, in February of 1998, which basically begins with the police saying, Brian, you're here to talk to us on your own free will. Yes, it's about the murder of John Kang. Well, we interviewed you in December. You said you didn't know anything about it, right? Yes. That was a lie, right? Yes. Why are you coming now to tell us what you know? Well, because there's a rumor going around that me and my brother had something to do with it, and I don't like that. However, the police knew that couldn't possibly have been plausible because they could have easily said, well, Brian, of course you had nothing to do with it. You were in custody.
So even his alleged motive to come forward was incredible. In fact, Brooks had a much more credible motive for making this statement.
Brian Brooks was in court for a whole host of armed robberies. Each armed robbery had assaults and weapons charges attached to him. And Brian was facing 200 to 400 years. And so Brian helped these officers in multiple different cases that he just didn't have knowledge about. He was just willing to say whatever needed to be said to take 200 to 400 years down to 5 years.
Brian Brooks would go into excruciating detail about the planning of the murder on the day before the murder, that Tyree and others came by James Davis's house. They're talking all about this big plan for the following night. And if this is to be believed, the day of the murder, Brian is being questioned in custody, ostensibly about a variety of crimes. He's not trying to work that down by saying, well, I've got something for you. There's something going down tonight. He doesn't do that. Fast forward now, it's February. And not only does he know everything, he knew it the day before it happened. Now, how is that?
That's a good question. Now, by this time, James Davis also made a statement about the meeting where he allegedly declined an invitation from Tyree Wallace and Raheem Shackelford to participate. That Matthew Corprew and Raheem Shackelford showed him a sawed-off shotgun shortly before the crime, and that Shackelford told him that they got $100 off Mr. Kang. In addition, Matthew Corprew admitted to being a lookout and implicated Shackelford and Tyree. And then the police went to LeVan Griffin with a photo array featuring Tyree, Corprew, and Shackelford.
And LeVan Griffin had his own issues and would later say that he was basically harassed by the police. And his testimony would later be a very weak and loose attempt to identify assailants. It was some loose reference to having a similar bust or a similar body, because LeVan Griffin didn't see the shooting.
All of this together was enough to charge Tyree Wallace, Matthew Corprew, and Raheem Shackelford with conspiracy to commit robbery and second-degree felony murder. And Tyree was arrested on February 20th, 1998.
Yes, I was at my father's house, and the phone rang. My father answered the phone upstairs. They asked, was Tyree there? And he calls down and says, Tyree, pick up the phone. And the front door gets kicked in. I get arrested. Once I get there, I was being interviewed by Detective Charles Boyle. And again, I'm 19 years old, nervous as all hell. So I say to him, I said, listen, sir, you have the wrong person. I had nothing to do with this crime. So he looked behind him, closed the door, turned around, looked me right in my eyes and said, you know what? He said, I believe you. He said, I don't give a fuck.
Thank you.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, Bo.
Hey, Matt.
Can you believe we have yet another very special episode coming up?
This one is very close to my heart. We'll be joined by a friend, the star of the upcoming Wicked film, the one and only Ariana Grande, will be here in the studio with us.
We hope this episode of Lost Coach gives you so much joy.
The episode is dropping this Wednesday, my birthday, November 6th.
And of course, please go see Wicked when it comes out.
November 22nd. Don't miss it.
Listen to Lost Culturistas on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chelsea Handler here on Dear Chelsea. I am joined by my longtime illegitimate baby named Kevin Hart. We talk about his birth. We talk about his afterbirth. We talk about his childhood, his adolescence, and that's pretty much where he is right now.
What do you mean you don't think?
What is going on with your legs that they need washing?
It's your body. You wash your body, Chelsea. Your entire body. You don't pick and choose.
I have hot spots. There's this harassment coming from one of us to the other person.
You to me.
Yeah, usually that's true. I'm not going to lie. Okay. And you take the abuse very well. You almost seem to enjoy it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've just grown accustomed to it.
Right. Like, okay. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Yeah.
That's what it is.
Find Dear Chelsea on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Marie.
And I'm Sydney.
And we're Mess. Well, not a mess, but on our podcast called Mess, we celebrate all things messy.
But the gag is, not everything is a mess. Sometimes it's just living.
Yeah, things like J-Lo on her third divorce.
Living. Girls trip to Miami.
Mess.
Ozempic.
Messy, skinny living. Restaurant stealing a birthday cake. Mess.
Wait, what flavor was the cake, though?
Okay, that's a good question.
Hooking up with someone in accounting and then getting a promotion.
Living. Breaking up with your girlfriend while on Instagram Live.
Living.
It's kind of mess.
Yeah. Well, you get it.
Got it?
Live, love, mess.
Listen to Mess with Sydney Washington and Marie Faustin on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the commission of a felony, if anybody is killed, everybody involved in that conspiracy receives a life sentence. So what people like Charles Boyle have been able to do is to weaponize that law. So he wasn't guessing. This was a blueprint that he was so confident in that he was just willing to reveal it to me. He said, let me tell you what the rest of your life is going to look like. You're going to spend the next 2 years at CFCF. Then you're going to get convicted of second-degree murder. They never had to accuse me of killing Mr. King. They never had to accuse anyone of killing Mr. King. All they had to do was convince a jury that these three young black men who didn't know each other were in a conspiracy to rob Mr. King. And as a result of that, he died and everybody gets a life sentence.
Raheem Shackelford says that when he goes into a courtroom for the first time to see Tyree, he says, who's that guy?
And as Tyree said earlier, he had only met Matthew Corpru once in passing. Nevertheless, just like Detective Boyle predicted, Tyree awaited trial for nearly 2 years. And he was tried along with his co-defendants in October 1999.
So I did have a court-appointed attorney, Daniel Green, and in retrospect, having an understanding of how this system works, when you think about the fact that the courts are in business and the DAs are in business of punishing crime, of getting convictions. So when they are appointing you a court-appointed attorney, your immediate thought is this person is here to save the day. And that's not necessarily the case. This person is here to meet the standard of, all right, he or she had representation. And a lot of times they are there to help facilitate this process. And nothing stood out more to me than during the trial when my father said he came into a courtroom and Daniel Green and Yvonne Ruiz, who was the disgraced fired ADA in my case, were just like, just chumming it up. So my father went and put the money together to get a paid attorney, put in a motion to have this attorney come on. This was 2 days before trial. And the judge said, well, listen, I can't stop you from bringing in a paid attorney, but I am not postponing this trial date. So the attorney has 2 days to learn his case.
So they stuck with Daniel Green, and it appears that every state's witness was coerced and or incentivized.
The narrative and the theory of the crime is that Shackelford and Tyree Wallace accost Kang, shoot him, take his money, with Corkru present as a lookout. And LeVan Griffin hears it. He turns around quickly enough to see Mr. Kang slump onto the ground, and he takes off running, scared.
Remember, the state's narrative was that the assailants had entered the store before the crime, and LeVan Griffin was coerced into making IDs with the threat of his own charges. In addition, he had seen only one shooter, who he described as short, chubby, and dark-skinned. Tyree is 6'2", slim, and light-skinned. Yet, Griffin still ID'd Shackelford and Tyree. So Tyree's lawyer was able to impeach Griffin on cross.
He read the description, though. And as you pointed out, I was the polar opposite. Not only height, but weight, skin color. Daniel Green asked LeVan Griffin directly, are you saying that my client is the person that came into the store? His response is no. He fit the description. So my lawyer said, listen, Your Honor, please tell him to stop saying it and just answer my question. So my lawyer asked him again, are you saying that he's the person who came into the store? He's saying no. He fit the description. So he said, Your Honor, please make him stop saying that. So the court stipulates that this was not an identification, that it was something lesser.
Then you had Matthew Corkru, who claimed to be a lookout, but his statement presented a familiar constitutional issue. Corkru has his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, and conversely, his co-defendants have the right to confront their accuser. So to satisfy everyone's rights, they had a redacted version of Corkru's statement read into the record.
They put Charles Boyle on the stand, who read his statement into evidence, where he would say, me and two guys planned to do this robbery. So it's three people on trial. He's saying, me and two guys. The fact that this detective is reading this into the evidence gives it validity.
And even though Tyree and Shackelford's names were carefully left out, LeVan Griffin had made his identification, however impeached he may have been. And remember, to convict them of conspiracy and second-degree felony murder, they didn't have to prove who killed Mr. Kang.
I didn't realize that the DA wasn't even trying to prove a legitimate connection between me and the scene. She was only trying to convince these 12 people that these three young black men were in a conspiracy to rob Mr. Kang. Now, that was not true, obviously, but that's a much lower standard.
So they heard testimony about the October 26th planning meeting, starting with James Davis and his mother, Sonia Godfrey.
His mother, I think, lied on the stand about time of day and what she said when she turns out she was at work and wasn't even home. And so she was caught in her lie. It sort of smelled like an effort to shield James Davis from being sucked into this whole thing. And it sounds like it worked.
When she was caught in a lie, she said that they made her say it. She didn't want to say it. Then when her son, under cross-examination, said that the police harassed him, that they brought him and his mother to the station three or four times.
For whatever reasons, James Davis never became engulfed in the police efforts back then, but there's seemingly a pretty consistent chorus of people who are incredulous of what James Davis had to say.
James Davis said that at the planning meeting, Shackelford and Tyree asked him to participate, but he declined. And then Shackelford and Corkru showed him a sawed-off shotgun prior to the crime, and after the fact told him that they only got $100 from Mr. Kang. And then Brian Brooks also claimed to have witnessed the meeting and that after the crime, Tyree told him that Shackelford was the shooter.
Brian tells this story. And then after he's finished giving his testimony, he goes back to the holding area of the courtroom and he turns to Sheriff John Hamilton and he says to the sheriff, hey, sheriff, what's the penalty for perjury? And the sheriff says, I don't know, 3 to 5 years. Why? He's like, well, I just lied up there. They made me say that. So the sheriff goes and reveals to the judge what this witness has just said to him within minutes of testifying in this case. There would be some delay there. The sheriff told me that as that was all unfolding, some of the other police around actually said to the sheriff, like, what are you, an inmate lover?
An inmate lover.
It was clearly very revealing about the culture in which a lot of these guys operated. And Sheriff Hamilton was like, No, I know right from wrong. I have to tell the court. So they brought the sheriff on the stand. They brought Brian Brooks back on the stand. And that's when the assistant DA basically said to Brian Brooks, hold on a minute. What happens to people who tell on other people in prison? What are they? They're snitches. So you're just really worried about being a snitch, right? Your testimony was accurate.
I didn't realize that the DA did a lot of things in that trial that she wasn't supposed to do as a prosecutor. But now I understand the purpose of it. The way she was able to explain Brian Brooks's recantation was just not true. But she did these things over and over again. She had a pattern in practice. So I need people to understand the DA, they have immunity from doing anything. They have to be seriously corrupt in order to get fired. And she wound up being fired.
But that was many years after it would have done Tyree any good. Meanwhile, the attorneys for all three were able to expose inconsistencies and falsehoods from LaVon Griffin, James Davis, and Sonia Godfrey, followed by Brian Brooks's in-court recantation. And then Tyree's alibi witnesses told the jury where he was that night.
He was at Damon Milligan's house with Damon Milligan's mother and girlfriend. But this house that they used to hang out with was a bit of a party house. Not exactly the most credible witness to put in front of a jury. They were easily discredited by the DA's office. So the alibi just sort of frittered away.
It also didn't clear him from the October 26th meeting.
There was another witness who would never be called, Jonathan Muldrew. Muldrew had gone down and spoken to either the DA or someone in the office, and he actually expected to be somehow called as a witness by the prosecution. Muldrew was at James Davis' home where this supposed planning session took place, and Muldrew was like, no, I'll tell you the truth and who was there and who wasn't there. Muldrew professes Tyree's innocence and complete uninvolvement. Tyree's lawyer tried to get Muldrew to come testify, and Muldrew was in the hospital. And there's an exchange where the judge says, look, I'll help you. If you need help, I'll serve a subpoena. We'll get him to the court if you need him to testify. And they just gave up.
Just gave up on the independent witness who could have destroyed the planning meeting evidence. So that left only his alibi witnesses against Corpru's redacted statement, the Van Griffin's lesser than ID, supported by the parade of discredited state's witnesses.
To me and the people who supported me, it seemed like an absolute no-brainer. When people are being caught in lies, when people are saying they didn't want to say it, the DA made me say it, when people are recanting. Like, at trial, this stuff is happening. You know what I mean? On top of the mindset that I can't be found guilty for something I didn't do. So I was almost certain that I was going to be found not guilty.
But remember, the standard was much lower. They just needed to get the jury to believe that these guys must have been involved in some way in the events that led to robbery and the resulting death, whether that was planning, actually robbing and shooting Mr. King, or even merely just being a lookout. And there appeared to be doubts about Corpru's guilt.
I think there was at least a jury question or note that had been passed, and it gave the prosecution a little bit of nervousness about getting a conviction on Corpru. So for whatever reason, or for those reasons, they would strike a deal with Corpru before the verdict would come down on Shackelford and Wallace.
So Corpru was not included in the verdict that led to life imprisonment for both Raheem Shackelford and Tyree Wallace.
My mindset was that I couldn't be found guilty because I didn't do it. Like, I genuinely, absolutely believe that, right? So, of course, that afforded hope, right? But then they read the verdict, and the verdict was guilty. It's hard for me to put in words how that felt. It was disbelief. It was not understanding. As soon as they gave me the opportunity, I spoke out immediately at trial and said, Your Honor, I did not commit this crime. It wasn't viewed as someone who didn't commit the crime fighting for their life, right? Which is what it was. It was viewed as this convicted murderer being disruptive.
We'll be right back.
Chelsea Handler here on Dear Chelsea. I am joined by my longtime illegitimate baby named Kevin Hart. We talk about his birth. We talk about his afterbirth. We talk about his childhood, his adolescence, and that's pretty much where he is right now.
What do you mean you don't think?
What is going on with your legs that they need washing?
It's your body. You wash your body, Chelsea. Your entire body. You don't pick and choose.
I have hot spots. There's this harassment coming from one of us to the other person.
You, to me.
Yeah, usually, yeah. That's true. I'm not going to lie. Okay. And you take the abuse very well. You almost seem to enjoy it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've just grown accustomed to it.
Right. Like, okay. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah. That's what it is.
Find Dear Chelsea on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Bo.
Hey, Matt.
Can you believe we have yet another very special episode coming up?
This one is very close to my heart. We'll be joined by a friend, the star of the upcoming Wicked film, the one and only Ariana Grande, will be here in the studio with us.
We hope this episode of Lost Coach gives you so much joy.
The episode is dropping this Wednesday, my birthday, November 6th.
And of course, please go see Wicked when it comes out.
November 22nd. Don't miss it.
Listen to Lost Culturistas on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Marie.
And I'm Sydney.
And we're Mess. Well, not a mess, but on our podcast called Mess, we celebrate all things messy.
But the gag is, not everything is a mess. Sometimes it's just living.
Yeah, things like J-Lo on her third divorce.
Living. Girls' trip to Miami.
Mess.
Ozempic.
Messy, skinny living. Restaurant stealing a birthday cake. Mess.
Wait, what flavor was the cake, though?
Okay, that's a good question.
Hooking up with someone in accounting and then getting a promotion.
Living. Breaking up with your girlfriend while on Instagram Live.
Living.
It's kind of mess.
Yeah. Well, you get it.
Got it?
Live, love, mess.
Listen to Mess with Sydney Washington and Marie Faustin on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So after I was sentenced to life, then I was shipped upstate. It was absolutely what you think prison is supposed to be like. It was extremely violent. It was extremely sexually violent. That was my first encounter with Central Pennsylvania COs and how they don't like people from Philly, how they particularly don't like black men. And it's my first time ever encountering this type of energy, right? This like disdain for me from people who don't know me. It was a violent energy. Now, fortunately, the neighborhood that I come from, South Philadelphia, had a strong presence in the institution. I went right into that fold. But then I immediately switched my mind to, all right, I have to fight this. And I got introduced to the law library and really got focused on learning. But I saw at a really quick pace that this is language that is created by this system. These are rules that are created by this system. And then the people who want to keep you in prison, they are the arbiter of whether you are successful or not.
His initial appeals were denied, as was his first post-conviction motion, or what is known as a PCRA, in 2002, which was based on ineffective assistance of counsel. While Tyree filed successive PCRAs, Matthew Corpru swore an affidavit for Raheem Shackelford's attorney in 2007, saying that he alone committed the robbery homicide, which Tyree only heard about in 2009. But in filing a new PCRA based on that affidavit, the state presented paperwork stating that Corpru was mentally ill and requested a psychologist to demonstrate what they had known at the time of trial.
Corpru was clinically insane at the time of trial. Major depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, and projection issues. And it dates back to when he was a child. The only reason I know this is because I've had access to his records as a result of the competency hearing. So they knew this about this man and still took a statement from him.
Obviously, the PCRA was denied, but Corpru should have never been relied on in the first place. Then, in 2013, the Pennsylvania Innocence Project signed on to Tyree's case, and they unearthed much of the exculpatory evidence that you've heard today.
Their private investigator went out, combed the community, spoke to Van Griffin. He wanted to come forward. Rashid Grant, same thing. Ricky Wilson, same thing. On and on and on and on and on. There is all of this evidence.
LeVan Griffin said that police threatened him with his own charges if he didn't say exactly what they wanted him to say. Rashid Grant and Ricky Wilson said the same thing that John Muldrow had said. Tyree was not at the October 26th planning meeting at James Davis's house. and another PCRA was filed.
There was a moment there around 2019 where it looked like witness interviews that with Muldrow and some other witnesses, they were going to maybe get some assistance from the court, but LeVan Griffin was supposed to show up. He didn't show up. And that was right before I got involved.
And even though the Pennsylvania Innocence Project routinely reaches out to private counsel to help with cases, that's not how David got involved. I mean, after all, he's an intellectual property lawyer.
So I started this movement here, which was called Man Up. And just a quick nutshell how that happened, when I was seeing all of this gun violence on TV, it was really the only people that was standing up to it were the women in the community. So my thought process was like, where are the men? So I said, what can I do about it in here? And I knew that a lot of the young guys who were here would be back in the outside. So I wanted to create a movement of men understanding what it was to be a man, what that meant for yourself, for your family and your community. And we created this movement called Man Up. So every week we would have 450 men. We had to turn away hundreds of people to get to the chapel every week. And the only thing that we were there for was to talk about being better men. Each week there would be a different topic. So if this week's topic was about community restoration, we would have five or six people would act out a skit, somebody do a song, outside guests come in and give speeches about community restoration. But then we would lay out plans for how we impact our community, which is how the Street Captain Initiative was born. Jobs came from this. My 501c3 nonprofit organization, Man Up, came as a result of this. We did street cleanings. We had Man Up hubs in different communities on the outside. So we did a lot of positive things based off of that.
The program was being so well received that there were questions about replicating it at other prisons. So we had some intellectual property questions.
So Dave came to see Man Up.
It was an amazing, almost revival-like program. And they would tackle topics like toxic masculinity or anger management or being a better father or fiscal responsibility. And eventually, through probably some deft subliminal messaging from Tyree to me, you know, he wanted me to play that counsel role. And I sort of resisted it for quite a while because it was not my lane. But I eventually, with the support of my firm, Blank Rome, and then collaborating with Keir Bradford Gray, and Keir having been the chief public defender in Montgomery County, having headed up the Defenders Association in Philadelphia, we became co-counsel for Tyree.
David and Keir Bradford Gray continued down the same path as the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, interviewing and re-interviewing witnesses.
I mean, Brooks has told us Tyree's innocent. Shackelford has told us Tyree's innocent. Muldrow knows Tyree had nothing to do with it. Davis said as much.
James Davis has since acknowledged that. I had no involvement in it. I wasn't at his home.
There's nobody in this entire chorus that says Tyree actually had anything to do with it.
As we understand it, the chorus to whom David is referring has unanimously named an alternate suspect who may or may not have been one of the state's trial witnesses. Now, we're certainly not in the business of making accusations that might lead to another wrongful conviction. So we're going to refer to the chorus of state witnesses and others who proclaim Tyree's innocence.
LeVan Griffin knows that Tyree Wallace, I mean, that how many more people? The sheriff who sat in the courtroom who has a pretty healthy experience of watching people testify, believes that Brian Brooks's recantation was actually the truth coming out. So the sheriff supports Tyree Wallace. The sheriff came up here and talked with us about it. He was shocked when he was contacted and found out that Tyree Wallace had been sitting in prison for years. He thought for sure there had been a mistrial after Brian Brooks's recantation.
So David and Keir Bradford Gray filed another PCRA in which all of the witnesses at trial have either recanted or been discredited. And with the court's typical reluctance to admit wrongdoing and the goal of at least getting Tyree home, David and Keir got the court to agree to resentencing.
Tyree's sentence was life without parole under second-degree felony murder. And on June 10th, 2024, we got his life sentence vacated, having been sort of put into a position where he would end up pleading to conspiracy to commit murder 3.
So this unwillingness to truly be accountable for the ills of the system, that is another part that has to be confronted.
So the fight to clear Tyree's name is not over. As far as his resentencing hearing on Monday, November 4th, 2024, there were a number of possible outcomes, the worst one being 20 to 40 years with parole eligibility. With optimism and anticipation, Tyree registered to vote and were happy to announce that he was released on time served and got a chance to vote for the very first time the following day. We're so happy for Tyree and his family, and again, we hope for their continued success as they continue to fight his case. In the meantime, we're going to link a fundraiser for Tyree's re-entry in the episode description, as he's not only going to need help to get by, but also to hit the ground running with the work he's been doing inside. And with that, we're going to go to closing arguments as we originally recorded them before this tremendous news.
I'm optimistic that we're going to have justice for Tyree. He's the kind of voice that we should want in our community. I think anyone who meets him feels like it's a bit of a privilege to have crossed his path and hear what he has to say. So we're going to bring him home. I'm confident about that. But Tyree's fight won't end then. He still deserves to be fully exonerated. He's going to want support, not only for himself personally to some degree, but Tyree is going to sort of set things alight, I think, in terms of fighting for others, trying to change policy. And he's going to want people who are listening and who are upset by his story or energized by it to join him, because it's going to take a whole chorus of people to make changes to the things that he faced so that he and others don't continue to have this happen.
I am extremely grateful for this opportunity. Again, it is not acceptable that my name still be attached to the robbery and killing of Mr. John Young Soo Kang. Once I am out, I am going to fight to make sure that my name is clear, that what happened to Mr. John Young Soo Kang is made clear. I want to do some things to honor his name and to respect his name in perpetuity. I am an open book. There are no questions that I do not want asked or answered. And again, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
Hi, I'm Marie.
And I'm Sydney.
And we're Mess.
Well, not a mess, but on our podcast called Mess, we celebrate all things messy.
But the gag is, not everything is a mess. Sometimes it's just living.
Yeah, things like J-Lo on her third divorce.
Living. Girls' trip to Miami.
Mess.
Breaking up with your girlfriend while on Instagram Live.
Living.
It's kind of mess.
Yeah. Well, you get it.
Got it?
Live, love, mess.
Listen to Mess with Sydney Washington and Marie Faustin on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Bo.
Hey, Matt.
Can you believe we have yet another very special episode coming up?
This one is very close to my heart. We'll be joined by a friend, the star of the upcoming Wicked film, the one and only Ariana Grande, will be here in the studio with us.
We hope this episode of Lost Coach gives you so much joy.
The episode is dropping this Wednesday, my birthday, November 6th.
And of course, please go see Wicked when it comes out.
November 22nd. Don't miss it.
Listen to Lost Culturistas on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chelsea Handler here on Dear Chelsea. I am joined by my longtime illegitimate baby named Kevin Hart. We talk about his birth. We talk about his afterbirth. We talk about his childhood, his adolescence, and that's pretty much where he is right now.
What do you mean you don't think?
No. What is going on with your legs that they need washing?
It's your body. You wash your body, Chelsea. Your entire body. You don't pick and choose.
I have hot spots. there's this harassment more coming from one of us to the other person.
You to me.
Yeah, usually that's true. I'm not going to lie. Okay. And you take the abuse very well. You almost seem to enjoy it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've just grown accustomed to it.
Right. Like, okay. That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah. That's what it is.
Find Dear Chelsea on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.